Okay, here I am again doing an audio blog because I didn't feel like typing anything today. I didn't bring my laptop computer back with me last night. I didn't really feel like carrying it either then or this morning. I didn't feel like taking the train into work either, so I caught an Uber, although it's expensive. I frankly don't feel like much of anything. I feel fairly empty. There are very few things that I do that give me anything but perhaps transient joy. And those things that give me transient joy are being taken away from me by circumstance, not by anyone. Maybe by me, I don't know. I'm having a lot of trouble with physical consequences from eating certain kinds of foods, so I've had to sort of curtail the kinds of foods I eat, and that gets frustrating and dispiriting because, as I think I've written about before, food, for biological reasons, is a fairly reliable source of immediate joy. Creatures that didn't have a tendency to enjoy eating were less likely to survive to leave successful offspring. But obviously it's not the only drive that we have. I am considering just eliminating most of my subscriptions. And I resubscribed to Hulu briefly because I wanted to watch that movie, No One Can Save You. And I watched it, and I don't expect to watch it again. And nothing else that I see on Hulu seems interesting. I resubscribed to Netflix to watch the series Wednesday. That was reasonably fun. I thought it was well cast. It was a tad heavy-handed, but it was fun. But there's not really much else on Netflix that I like. I had subscribed to Disney, largely for the Marvel and Star Wars movies. But of course, the Star Wars movies and shows have gone downhill, or at least become less interesting to me. I'm afraid that they just don't have whatever flair George Lucas brought to the project, since he, after all, created it. And yes, sometimes his stuff was clunky. He wasn't good at doing romance. But there certainly was a certain special something there. And the story arc of Anakin Skywalker is a tragedy worthy of Sophocles or Shakespeare, if not in its scripting, certainly in its story. The Marvel movies, based on the best of the Marvel comics, which, you know, being comics, have their ups and downs and aren't always great, nevertheless, use characters that had so much history in the comic books that there was a lot to work with. And with Stan Lee present and people feeling beholden to try to be true to his visions, I think it helped. Because to a large extent, the Marvel movies have also gone downhill after Stan Lee's death. I don't know if that's the cause for them going downhill. I just know that that has coincided with it. Correlation does not necessarily imply causation, even if it seems to be a good story. Nothing wrong with a good story, but you shouldn't assume that just because something is a good story, it's an accurate explanation of the facts of reality. It may be, but if you want to find out for sure, you have to test it and try to pick it apart. If you keep trying to pick it apart and you fail, using reasonable and sensible means, not fallacies and ad hominem attacks and blanket dismissals and so forth, then at least it's got some plausible objectivity to it. But that conclusion that it's correct is always in principle provisional. Now, there's some things we come to conclusions about that are technically provisional, but that the evidence for and the failure of evidence against has been so consistent that it's reasonable to proceed as if they are true, until and unless some new reason presents itself to doubt them. For instance, I'm pretty convinced that the principles of aeronautics are right. And so are the many millions of people who fly in planes every day and survive. If the principles of aeronautics were significantly wrong, air travel would not be what it is. We may be mistaken about the specifics of what causes lift in a plane. I know there's been some controversy over whether it's truly the difference in rate of airflow over the top of a wing versus the bottom, or merely the angle of attack with the redirecting of the force of the air, or a combination thereof, which seems more likely to me, but that's just me. But something's working there. Similarly, Newtonian mechanics, which are also involved in aeronautics. Force equals mass times acceleration. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. All that other good stuff. That all seems to be consistent. And, of course, the object at rest remains at rest. The object in motion remains in motion, except when acted upon by some force, which turns out to be another way of explaining the fact that in the framework of general relativity, things travel through space time along geodesics, however it's pronounced properly, unless they are acted upon or prevented from doing so by some external force. Thus, the force that you feel as gravity is really actually the Earth getting in the way of you being able to free fall the way your body wants to through space-time, and is more caused by the warping of time than the warping of space in the vicinity of a mass such as the Earth. There are some good videos that explain this. PBS Space-Time does some. I'm sure there's others. That's the one I like the best, but there are plenty of other good people explaining how that works. There's some good analogies to, for instance, some two conjoined boats floating down a river, one closer to shore than the other, and the water in a river that's closer to a shore tends to move less quickly, and so the outer boat will tend to go forward faster, and that will curve it, all other things being equal, unless it's steered against. And the flow through time in general relativity is similar to that. The closer you are to a mass like the Earth, the slower time goes, or the slower you pass through time, perhaps, is a better way to put it. And so things further away will tend to go faster and will curve inward, in a sense. And remember, this is curving inward in space-time, but we only experience movement through space directly. Moving through time, of course, we experience, but not in the same way. And this tendency to follow geodesics or geodesics is why light curves in space too, even though it has no mass. It has energy, of course, and energy and mass are interchangeable for the purposes of relativity, but that's a different issue. Well, it's maybe probably not a different issue, but I don't know where I'm getting at right now, but that's the point anyway. And it is interesting to note that in special relativity, certainly, but also in general relativity, though it gets more complicated because of the potential curvature of the space-time, everything is moving always, in a sense, at the speed of light. It's just if you're not moving, so to speak, assuming, if you will, a resting frame of reference. If you're not moving relative to things around you, all of your motion is through time. You're moving through time, so to speak, at the speed of light, if you're standing still. When you start moving, the net vector, the length of your vector, doesn't change, but it tilts a little bit into space. So your motion through time is changed, which is why the Lorentz transformations bear a resemblance to solutions to Pythagorean theorems, because you're basically dealing with triangles. You have a fixed hypotenuse length, and you need to determine the lengths of the legs of the hypotenuse. So if you tilt the hypotenuse away from straight up, then you drop a perpendicular. You have a portion of that that's going in the x direction, a portion of it's going in the y direction. The portion of the Y direction shrinks as the portion of the X increases. It's a little more complicated because it uses hyperbolic geometry, and the default, well, to make things simple, basically the speed of light is determined to be 1, and it just makes things easier. And that way the objects that move at the speed of light in a space-time diagram are effectively drawn at moving at a 45-degree angle. At a 45-degree angle, all motion is through space. There is no motion through time. And again, that doesn't work with typical Euclidean geometry. That would, you'd be going all the way down to the x-axis for all your motion to be through space, and none of your motion to be through time. But again, this is talking about personal time. Time in relativity is always a local thing to experience. The faster an object that has some complexity to it, some structure to it, is moving, the slower any processes go for it as seen from outside. The object itself, of course, experiences whatever it experiences, or does whatever it does. Probably most things don't have any experience. But a photon, for instance, doesn't quote-unquote experience anything. It doesn't experience the passage of time. A photon that leaves one source and then millions of years later, according to an outside observer, strikes a photosensor, that photon just quote-unquote knows being emitted and being absorbed. No space of time in between. And if you were able to go the speed of light exactly, you would experience no time. You would also have infinite mass, which is one reason why matter can't go at the speed of light. There's a question of whether when hypothetical objects like tachyons could go faster than the speed of light, and only faster than the speed of light, and so it would be at more than 45-degree angles on the space-time diagram, and their time would be working in a very weird way, which you sort of wonder, well, if something was going very near the speed of light, could there be a tunneling phenomenon? If so, it probably would be very, very, very rare. I've often wondered if one were able to accelerate, say, for instance, a spaceship, really, and get it really, really, really close to the speed of light, eventually it would, you know, the mass of whatever accelerated it would be converted into its energy, and it would be, to the outside observer, an extremely compact, dense mass, and eventually would pass the Schwarzschild limit and all that other stuff, and should collapse into a black hole from the view of an outside observer. From the view of the people on the spaceship, it's the outside world that would be contracting and contracting in the direction of their motion, making the distance between things shorter to them, which would make everything equivalent, because it all has to come out the same in the end. The space-time interval between events has to be the same, no matter who's measuring it. But is there a way, like, what would happen to such a ship at the point where it reached the Schwarzschild limit? Now, there've been thoughts about if certain forms of string theory were correct and the higher spatial dimensions were large enough, particles accelerated in particle accelerators like the Large Hadron Collider could conceivably experience a strong enough gravity to temporarily collapse into local black holes. And then, because tiny black holes radiate away almost instantly thanks to Hawking radiation, which seems to be a real thing, as far as everyone could tell, but it has never been directly observed, but corollary things have been observed and tested and measured and seem to be consistent, then that would have been a detectable event because, of course, whereas large particles when colliding tend to produce offshoots of particular characteristics, a micro black hole evaporating should, in principle, give off its mass and energy in a more or less random assortment of particles. There are, I'm sure, specifications about what it would be likely to be, but it would be detectable. Anyway, there was no such detection. I do wonder, though, because the mass is contracted only in the direction of motion, how that affects the way a particle would contract or a spaceship would contract into a black hole if it reached that level. And would that change the fact of it being a black hole? I know that there are people who have done the maths for things like super cosmic strings, not string theory strings, which would be extraordinarily massive but extremely fine one-dimensional things that have length but almost no width and extremely high mass, and they are not black holes because, of course, something that's as long as the universe, perhaps effectively, well, infinite length is tricky, but very, very, very long, can't collapse in the direction of its length. So it has different properties. Among them, I think if you went around it in a certain fashion, you can effectively go backward in local time. Whether that would be useful is another question. But it is interesting, and it's sort of, I think you can see why I get intrigued by this and want to understand it all better, so that I could try to really get a feel for how this sort of thing would work. Because I've never encountered anybody dealing with the issue of a spaceship traveling close enough to the speed of light where it passed the limit and would or should become a black hole, and whether the fact that that limit, that density, is only in the direction of motion, that its width is still the same even to outside observers, does that make a difference? They seem to not think it would make a difference in the Large Hadron Collider if there were large enough contracted dimensions to allow gravity become stronger there. But I think the math is probably more complicated than even they were able to. Well, obviously the string theorists positing that weren't able to get any good data on it anyway, because if there are extra curl-up dimensions, they're too small to be probed at the energies of the Large Hadron Collider. They should be probed eventually with certain very high energy cosmic rays, you would think, but maybe those sorts of cosmic rays do funny things and we never encounter them or measure them hitting the atmosphere, precisely because they do funny things and collapse into micro black holes, and then because the rate of radiation of a micro black hole is inversely proportional to its size, they would quote-unquote evaporate almost instantly, becoming something else. I don't know. I don't know how I got on this topic. How did I get on this topic? Anyway, it's already over 20 minutes for my base recording time. Obviously, I'm going to truncate my silences and bring it down to whatever the final length is, but I didn't expect it to go on this long. Obviously, if I'm going to figure this stuff out, I'd have to learn a lot more. To do that, I'd have to have a lot of energy to do it. And I don't have hardly any energy at all. I hardly have any energy at all. I can barely face the prospect of commuting to the house and commuting back to work. There's no feeling that the house is a welcoming place, although at least it's quiet and it's my space. There's no feeling of relief about getting back to the house. There's no feeling of relief about being in the office. There's no satisfaction of a job well done. Not really. But I can't not try to do my job well. That's just me. I don't know. Anyway, I'm working tomorrow, so I'll either speak or write another blog post. I hope you're all having a better time than I am. Thanks.